It's Inside Vancouver Opera, and my name is Ashley Daniel Foote, and we're back for another season of behind-the-scenes content and explorations into all things opera. And today, we're talking with director extraordinaire Ashley Corcoran.
I was so fascinated with how opera singers could use the music to fast forward to their objectives, their intentions, the emotions.
Ashley is also the artistic director of the Arts Club Theatre Company and has directed all over Canada, has an illustrious career, and she's lots of fun to talk to. I heard a rumor that Mozart might be your favorite composer. Is this true?
Yeah, I love Mozart. I always feel a little bit shy saying that he's my favorite because I don't think it's the most unique answer, but it's the truth, and I think it's important to be true to yourself. I can listen to any piece of Mozart on repeat, and it sounds beautiful, but it feels even more beautiful inside of my body. And what I love about him in terms of his opera writing is how specific and connected the music is to the characterization for each of the characters, as well as the tone and the feeling of the entire opera. Every bar he's written, and there's not a bar that's wasted in terms of clarifying who these people are and why they're doing what they want to be doing, what actions they're doing. And so that combination of the music with the theater is what makes him my favorite composer in terms of opera composers.
How many operas have you done with us now? What number are we at?
This is my second opera that I've been the director for. And way back in 2012, I was an assistant director here at Vancouver Opera. So my third piece here.
This production is a remount of a Diane Paulus production that was at the COC. Tell us a little bit about how you approach such a scenario. What is your role? How does it differ from a normal brand new opera?
I think that remounts are their own kettle of fish, and I would say this remount is its own like ladle inside of that kettle in terms of it's a piece I know really well, and in fact was an assistant director when Diane staged it back in 2011 and got to really get my hands dirty that first time round working directly with the singers and also with there was an ensemble studio production at the COC. So really got to like feel part of the creation of the piece from that point on. And then a couple years later, I actually staged it again at Opera Philadelphia in 2013. And then in 2017, I staged it again at the Canadian Opera Company. And then was intended to stage it a year and a half ago again at the Canadian Opera Company and then wasn't able to at the last moment. But it's a piece that I've lived with a lot. And so as much as it's a revival of a different director's concept, it's a piece that I have been privileged to live beside for more than a decade. So I feel very close to it and have gotten to see how the piece has changed each time I've done it with new singers, as new singers bring their ideas and layer their new ideas into it. And then I remember those ideas the next time I work with another group of singers and get to share this like more detailed, more layered story. And then those singers bring their ideas and layer it on. And so, yeah, I think anytime you're doing a remount, you have to really understand where the original director, original conceivers came from. And because I was part of that first production and then I've had a chance to direct it myself several times, doing it for Vancouver Opera this time really feels like returning home and getting to see friends. Literally, there are people in this cast who I've directed before in these parts. There are other friends who I've directed elsewhere or know from elsewhere who are playing parts for the first time. And then there's a whole group of new singers that I've never worked with. And I'm getting to meet them as well.
The way that you're describing it, it's almost onion-like in the number of layers of beauty that you're unpacking. And I think you've talked about the jewel box aspect of the show and how you have really engaged with the theatricality of the piece. Can you talk a little bit about how, in a way, we're kind of envisioning the creative process within this work?
The container for this production is that it's being set in 1791, which was the year that Magic Flute was first performed. We've set it at the name day celebration for a young aristocratic woman, and it's her father who's throwing this party for her. The kind of main way they're celebrating her name day or celebrating her is that they're all putting on a play together. They're putting on an opera, and so they're putting on the Magic Flute. So we, as the audience at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre, are actually witnessing a community come together and tell this story. And so the chorus is on stage for the entirety of Act One. They are there as guests at this party or servants of the main aristocrat. And they are either putting on the play, putting on the opera themselves, or they are an audience witnessing it. The main set piece is this little jewel box proscenium arch theater that's adorable. I say little, but it's of course like it's little, but it's also huge. You have to figure out a way to store it offstage. That first act all takes place there. And the characters that we've been introduced to in the overture who are, you know, the head of the household or the head servant or young woman whose birthday it is, they're taking on roles like Zarastro or Papageno or Pamina. And the first act is a real celebration, a real love letter to theater, a real love letter to opera of what it means to put on a play together. And I love like the design elements to it. They're all stereotypical theater. So there's rocks, but they're rock flats, which I really love. There's a little Zauber drop that comes in and out of the little tiny proscenium arch. So we get to do reveals. Queen of the Night, her backdrop is an homage to the really famous 1815 star drop for the Queen of the Night. There's all these little Easter eggs for people who love opera or people who love theater. And the performance style is like, it's witty and playful, and it is kind of performative in that first act. And then the second act, they leave behind the jewel box stage and the show and the actors, like the participants at this party who've been acting in this show in act one, they take their play, their opera, and they bring it deeper and farther into the grounds of the estate, and they end up getting kind of lost in this maze of hedges. And so the piece, it starts to lose some of the, like the play within a play, and the characters are starting to drop into their acting style more. So it's less performative and more authentic. And so they start to really believe it. I was saying that it's like Dungeons and Dragons in 1791 or like a murder mystery party where you're like, am I in my character right now or am I being myself right now as I make these choices? And that's,
I love it.
That's what happens in this act. So yeah, so the first act is more about love letter to theater, and the second act is more about exploring ritual and how ritual affects and changes us.
When you think about ritual and how it affects and changes us, like you just said, where do you start with that? What kind of rituals are you thinking about?
In this opera, it's all tied to Masonic rituals.
Yeah, absolutely.
These men who are guests at the party don kind of priest robes, so they're playing a part. They aren't actually priests, but they're playing the priests. And they're inviting Tamino to go through these steps to emerge a wiser, more whole human as part of their brotherhood. What I love about Diampolis's original conception of this piece is that Pamina comes with him on this journey and that she's an equal in the journey. Through Act Two, there are different trials that they need to embark on. And I think that's the connection to ritual in this piece. Is it a play that they're putting on, or are they actually experiencing these rituals? It gets a little bit blurry in Act Two.
You mentioned how opera, in many ways, has had a moment of transformation. We're at a place where we're questioning everything we know about the art form. And I think by exploring both the theatricality and wondering about these rituals, you're also unpacking like what opera means today. I wonder, have you had any notions or thoughts about that as you're approaching it this time around and having directed so many operas? Like, where do you think we're all at?
That gives me two things that I wanted to share. One, which is coming back to this opera now after having like quite a big break from opera because of the pandemic. And then I had a little boy and Yay. There are all sorts of reasons. This is the first opera I've directed since January 2020 or February 2020. What's made me fall even more in love with this production is how it is about a group of people coming together to celebrate, which is something that I missed more than anything else during that crazy period. And the way they're celebrating is putting on a play or putting on an opera. I say play because they sing in character and out of character. So it's like, where does the opera start and end? I always wonder about. And the other thing about this particular conception is because the chorus is on stage for the entirety of Act One and then it's kind of more participating in Act Two, we get to see how the telling of this story affects this community. And so in the first act, people are pretty separate. The chorus is pretty separate in terms of, are they the male upper class guests? Are they the local women? Are they the servants? And by the time we tell the story and we get to the celebration at the end, they're all celebrating together and the different classes and gender groups are more mixed. I think it's a piece about how putting on a play together, telling a story together can change and affect a community. So that's one thing I think about. The other is that there's a lot of tricky content, boring, old-fashioned content in a lot of operas that, you know, I'm over, we're all over, right?
Yeah.
What I like about the play within a play concept, I was saying to the singers, that it gives us a bit of space from it and can make us have space to be curious. And so some of the content, like the misogyny in Magic Flute, they as singers are playing characters who are playing roles. So we as singers can decide how the characters feel about the roles or what they're saying. And we can include that in our performance. And so in a way, have an attitude or comment on some of the content, which is incredibly old fashioned and in some cases harmful.
Absolutely. It's a conversation we were having with Rachel Peake last year as you were unpacking The Pearl Fisher. Is a very, very challenging work on many levels.
Yes.
I'm wondering, there was something you said earlier about that whole missing putting on a play. I want to take you back, way back. Mm-hmm. When did you first decide that that was something you wanted to do?
I decided in grade 12 that I was going to study English and biology at Queen's University because you could do a double major in the sciences and the arts. And I had a hard time deciding if I wanted to go into sciences or arts. And then at the last minute, I changed it to drama and English. And I didn't know why. I had seen my first big show. I saw Les Mis at the Queen Elizabeth Theater. So it's really exciting for me to be directing at Queen Elizabeth because it's like the start of all of it. I remember when I saw Les Mis when I was 13 years old, I couldn't understand how the words were floating in the sky and they were being projected on the scrims. But I just was like, how is this happening? Magic. It's magic. Yeah. And I remember, I don't know why this would have happened, but I remember keeping my brother and my dad in the auditorium after the audience had left and they had pulled up the curtain and they were striking things. I don't know why that would have happened, but I saw the walls, like the backstage Amazing. Walls of the Queenie. And when I came here to assist on Barber, I was like, it's the same. Like, it's not a dream I had. That's a real memory. But I remember at that point being like, how do they do this? Who are all those people backstage? Yeah. I'm curious about those people. And so I held that inside of me from the time that I was 13. And, you know, my parents would take us to pantomimes. And I think we saw Phantom of the Opera. Like, we saw some theater, but it wasn't a huge part of my upbringing. And so then I surprised everyone at the last minute when I changed this application and changed it to drama and English. And my biology teacher cried because I did really love biology. And she said, you're going to Hollywood to be an actor. And I was like, no, that's not what I want to do. It's something else. And I thought it was maybe stage management. So that year I bought a textbook on stage management. In my first year of university, I took one drama class and stage managed a show using that textbook. And I found an email that I sent my parents at the time, telling them how great university was. It's a really short email. It's like, it's so great to be here. The play is going really well. I love Brad, the director. I love the cast. I'm really liking stage managing, but I think I want some more creative control. I think I want to be a director. And I don't remember writing that email, but I can totally, totally understand that I felt that way. I can remember the feeling of feeling that way. And so then I started just trying to study as much as I could because I felt like a director should understand the whole picture. So I started taking playwriting classes, admin classes, acting classes, design classes, directing classes. And then it's very, very lucky that I found this thing that I love so much that I am so lucky that I get to do every day. Opera came later. So I finished my undergrad. I went and did a master's degree in England again in directing. Came back to Toronto at the time and I was working for a year or so after my master's degree. And then I saw a posting for the ensemble studio at the Canadian Opera Company. It was like a way to make money and learn about directing. And I was just like, I was temping, you know, I was scrambling to make money to pay for rent and then also figuring out where I could learn more about directing. So it seemed like this amazing opportunity, but I also felt like, oh, I'm not an opera director, I'm a theater director. So maybe I shouldn't do this. And then I tucked myself into just applying and I got through to the callback situation. And the callback was directing some members. So their ensemble studio is their young artist program. And so the callback was directing some members from it, an hour on a Così fan tutte piece, and then an hour on an Albert Herring tenor aria. And both of those hours were just like the best time of my life. I was so excited. I was so fascinated with how opera singers could use the music to fast forward to their objectives, their intentions, the emotions, and kind of just get there so quickly. And I loved it. And so up until that point, I kind of been like, well, if I get it, amazing. But you know, if I don't get it, it's okay. I'm just applying for things. I'm just trying to put myself out there. And then as soon as I did those callbacks, I desperately wanted to get into that program and very luckily did. So that was back in 2006. So I was saying yesterday on the first day of rehearsal here that I always say like, oh, I've come late. I've just started doing opera. But actually, that was 18 years ago. So time flies when you're having fun. So now, because I have this wonderful job at the Arts Club, which keeps me very busy, I can do about one show a year away. And I really love to prioritize making that an opera and connecting with that part of my practice. I hope people come see The Magic Flute. It's a perfect piece for beginners into opera. I've been listening to the music and my two-year-old has been singing some of Papageno's arias. Like, it's like so accessible. And then also, if you are an astute lover of classical music, it's also some of the most sublime. We're about to stage the Act One Quintet after lunch, and I can't wait to look at it because it's probably one of my most favorite pieces of music ever. And it's transcendent. I hope people come, whether they're new to opera, whether they, you know, have seen Magic Flute 20 times already. I think there'll be something for everyone.
All right. Well, that's a wrap. What a great conversation. So now it's your turn. Head over to vancouveropera.ca to buy your tickets for The Magic Flute from October 21st to 29th at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. You should buy your tickets now at vancouveropera.ca, and I'll see you at the opera.